Hello. Despite all of the various disruptions of the previous centuries, in AD 600, the Mediterranean world remained a place of great empires. Dwelling in the former territories of the Western Roman Empire, so places like Spain, Italy, North Africa, and Europe, were a large number of barbarian kingdoms. In the east, stretching from the coast inland to Mesopotamia, was the vast and very powerful Sasanian Empire, which was the heir to the Persians and the Parthians. And situated between the west and the east was, of course, the Byzantine Empire, firmly based around Constantinople. And the fringes of this world were inhabited by various minor groups. Among these was a set of semi-nomadic desert tribes who lived in the Arabian Peninsula. And just as they had for many centuries, these people, sometimes called the Arabs or sometimes the Bedouins, lived a very hard life on the very edges of civilization, trying to scrape out a living in what was an extremely hostile climate. As a people, they tended to be very proud, clannish, somewhat aloof, and they were still pagans. And they had no overarching political organization, but instead would just group themselves into little familial tribes. And in a lot of ways, they resembled desert-dwelling versions of some of the earlier northern barbarian tribes. But within 100 years of their conversion to the last of the three great monotheistic religions to arise from the Mediterranean basin, these formerly obscure nomads would sweep out of the desert and topple kingdom after kingdom until they had conquered half the Mediterranean world. In the process, they would permanently shatter the unity of that world, they would spin its constituent parts onto divergent paths, and they would establish religious, linguistic, and cultural boundaries that still exist today. That remarkable conquest, which I think arguably is the greatest in all of history, at least in terms of its scope and its permanence, begins with an unlikely source. A less than successful, middle-aged businessman who lived in the town of Mecca in the Arabian Peninsula at the beginning of the 7th century. Unsatisfied with his life, this man began roaming into the wilderness outside of Mecca, often going to a cave where he would meditate. And it was in this cave, in AD 610, that he experienced a vision in which the angel Gabriel appeared to him and taught him a revelation from God. The angel then commanded that he recite back this revelation. And over the next 20 years or so, more than 100 further revelations followed. And collected together, these lessons became known as the Quran, which means literally the recitations. That man, of course, was Muhammad, and the religion that he founded was Islam. The religion established by Muhammad advocated a very stark form of monotheism, in which the primacy of God as the one and the only deity was stressed very heavily. And so nothing was allowed to come between God and the worshiper. Acknowledging God's omnipotence and submitting yourself to his will were all important within this religion. And we can see this concept reflected in the word Islam itself, which can be translated as submission. Muhammad identified God, or in Arabic Allah, as the same God who is worshipped by the Jews and the Christians. And so in Islam, figures such as Abraham, Moses, and even Jesus are venerated as human beings who were prophets and who had received earlier divine revelations from God. Muhammad, then, was simply the last in this long line of prophets. But he was the one who had been given the fullest and the most accurate version of God's message. And this whole figure of the prophet, the Rasul, was very important in early Islam. He is the one sent by God to warn his people. And at least in early Islam, there was very little formal church structure. So there were no equivalent to priests or other figures who would be intercessors between God and his worshipers. And the reason for this was that, again, Islam stressed that ultimately each person would have to stand alone before God and be judged. And the fear of that judgment is what should motivate believers. The Islamic concept of heaven, of course, was very obviously also the vision of a desert-dwelling society. So heaven was envisioned as a paradise of lush green gardens with lots and lots of water, which is the very opposite of the harsh desert that these Bedouins lived in. The core of Islam is based around a set of moral injunctions, which generally are pretty similar to those found in Judaism and Christianity. You might even argue that they're stricter than some branches of Christianity, since things like alcohol and gambling are forbidden. But also, Islam is based upon the so-called five pillars of faith. The first of those is to simply affirm and to state the fundamental creed of Islam, which is Allah is the only God and Muhammad is his prophet. The second pillar is to, of course, pray five times every day while facing in the direction of Mecca. The third is to fast during the holy month of Ramadan, and Ramadan is the ninth month in the Islamic calendar, and currently that corresponds to late July and August. The fourth is to try to make a pilgrimage to Mecca at least once in your life, and to perform a whole series of rituals there. There is a provision, however, that exempts you from that requirement if you're too poor or physically unable to make such a trip. And finally, the fifth pillar of Islam is to give alms to the poor and to generally assist those who are needy. Muhammad's teachings were not initially very popular among the urban people of Mecca. Rising tensions with those people peaked in 622 AD, with the result that Muhammad and his followers had to actually flee from Mecca. And they ended up going to a fairly nearby city called Yathrib. Now that city is Medina, which means the city of the Prophet. And that event, which later becomes a pivotal moment in Islam, is called the Hijra, literally meaning the flight or the escape. And so important is the Hijra that it marks the beginning of the Islamic calendar. So the Islamic year 1 is equivalent to the year 622 in the Christian calendar. While Muhammad steadily gained converts in cities such as Medina, the people among whom the new religion really took hold were the hardy Arab tribes who lived in the surrounding deserts. They are the ones who embraced it enthusiastically and wholeheartedly. And by the time of Muhammad's death in 632, Islam had spread throughout these clans. And it is those people who would form the core of the armies that soon would burst out of the Arabian Peninsula. Under the leadership of Muhammad's four caliphs, or successors, these tribes exploded into the Mediterranean world, and in an incredibly short amount of time, conquered vast territories. In a sense, these expeditions were just a continuation on a huge scale of the old Bedouin raids that had been a key part of the lifestyle of these desert nomads. But nevertheless, mounted on their swift-moving camels, these raiders just rolled irresistibly over all their opponents. Egypt fell to them in 642, and the southern Mediterranean coast, including what today is Libya and Tunisia, soon followed. To the east, their triumphs were even more impressive, as the entire Middle East was just overwhelmed. Syria and Mesopotamia were overrun, and even the powerful Sasanian Empire was toppled. Jerusalem itself, the most sacred city in all of Christendom, fell in 636. And all of this happened in just the first 30 years after the death of Muhammad. In the next couple generations, which would be known as the Umayyad Caliphate, these Muslim armies would push even further. So all the rest of North Africa, up through the modern borders of Morocco were captured. And then the Arabic armies even crossed the Straits of Gibraltar and seized most of the Spanish peninsula. To the east, the frontier just kept getting pushed further and further until they got into Central Asia, nearly to the borders of India. In the eastern Mediterranean, this great wave of conquest was only slowed and eventually stopped by the stubborn resistance of the Byzantine Empire, which fought a long series of bitter wars against the invaders. And this culminated in the defeat of a great Muslim naval expedition right in front of the walls of Constantinople itself in 717 AD. To the west, in France, the Battle of Tours in 732, at which a coalition of various European powers got together and managed to fight the Muslim forces to a draw. And that then marked the high water mark of invasion in that direction. Just a couple years later, in 738, the Rajas of northern India similarly came together and managed to defeat a Muslim army, and so put a stop on further expansion in that direction. So this initial great wave of conquest finally subsided around the mid-8th century. But looking back in a little bit longer than 150 years, these series of campaigns had fundamentally changed the map of the world. They had created new political, religious, linguistic, and ethnic boundaries. The Arabs themselves were very much aware of the astonishing speed of their conquest, and just how quickly they had gone from being completely obscure, marginal desert nomads to what really amounted to rulers of much of the world. For example, one Arab ambassador to the Persian court once said, "At one time, the Arabs were a wretched race, whom you could tread underfoot with impunity. We were reduced to eating dogs and lizards. But for our glory, God raised up a prophet among us." In these lightning-swift military operations, one special weapon that gave the Muslim armies an edge, especially in desert regions, was the camel. Camels can go for almost a week without water, and they can carry very heavy loads, much more than a horse, long distances. Camels could cross dry terrain in which horses would simply die. And so the camel gave its riders a range and a speed that would often bewilder the enemies of the Arabs. In warfare, mobility always counts for a lot. And the mobility given to the Muslim armies by the camel was a key factor in their success. And so because of this, one famous historian has likened the camel to being the tank of the 7th century AD. In addition, these conquests benefited a bit because of their timing. They came along at a point at which the Byzantines and the Sasanians had sort of fought one another to a standstill and had exhausted one another. And so when the Arabs showed up, they were unable to mount a very strong or effective defense. And for a lot of the states around the Mediterranean, they were also weak and disorganized at this particular moment in time. As conquests go, these invasions were relatively non-destructive. So the new Islamic overseers, generally speaking, were tolerant of other religions. They tended to leave the existing social and political structures in place. They just simply came in and took over at the top, and then they would collect the taxes. As this initial phase of expansion came to a close, the Umayyadic capital of the Islamic world was moved from Mecca to Damascus. Now, the Umayyads would not actually get to enjoy their new empire for very long. They were soon overthrown and replaced by a new dynasty of Muslim rulers known as the Abbasids. And this began with a revolt in 750 in Persia. Ethnically speaking, the Abbasids were Persian converts to Islam. And so, with their ascendancy, the capital of the Islamic world shifted eastward yet again into the former territory of the Persian Empire. And the new capital city that was established was Baghdad. That was founded in 762, only a couple miles away from one of the old Persian royal cities, Ctesiphon. Meanwhile, the lone survivor of the Umayyads escaped all the way to Spain, where he established a cultural center at Cordoba, which would thrive for at least another three centuries. Baghdad's location in a very, what was at the time at least, well-irrigated, fertile farming region was a good location because it was where a lot of important trade routes came together. And this allowed the city to grow rich and to flourish. And Baghdad developed into a crucial center of commerce at which goods and ideas from all over the known world arrived and from which these were then passed on to Europe and to other parts of Asia. And the fact that Muhammad himself had been a merchant and had often expressed respect for people who followed that profession. He called them the couriers of the horizon and God's trusted servants on earth. And so that made being a merchant a worthy profession in Islam. And so these trade routes spread all throughout Muslim territory. Crops from all kinds of places, rice, sugarcane, lemons, watermelons, spinach, cucumbers, were planted in this very agriculturally productive area and became staples of the Muslim diet. Later, the Crusaders who came over to this region would then be exposed to some of these foodstuffs, and they would take them back to Europe with them, from which they would eventually diffuse throughout the Americas. So the sugarcane plantations in the Caribbean, the orange groves of Brazil, have their origins in the Middle East here. Surplus food fueled rapid population growth and urban expansion, so that by 900, Baghdad had developed into one of the world's largest cities. And its cosmopolitan nature was enhanced because there were lots of foreign traders there, and they were shown tolerance by the Abbasid rulers, so they were allowed to practice their own religions and customs. And a large Jewish community arose in Baghdad. Also Persians, many of whom attained high-ranking government posts, continued to have a strong influence in the government there. They developed all kinds of sophisticated economic tools. Banks were developed, joint stock companies, and bills of exchange, or as they were called in Arabic, checks. And these sort of things further encouraged investment and trade. In the 8th century, the skill of papermaking was imported from China. And so paper mills were set up at Baghdad. And that also was an important step in the diffusion of ideas. This sudden availability of a nice writing material, of paper, gave scholarship new energy, and it stimulated the publishing of books. The manufacture of paper also meant that copies of the Quran could be more easily produced, helping to spread Islam even further. All sorts of libraries and universities were established in most large Muslim cities. And the University of Al-Azhar in Cairo became so famous that it would serve as a model for some of Europe's later medieval universities. The Abbasid Caliphate would last for several hundred years, and it's often regarded as constituting an Islamic golden age. During this era, and especially places like Baghdad, knowledge, scholarship, and science were highly prized and were actively encouraged. So Islamic scholars would study texts, and one of the things they did is that they preserved the various texts they had which bore the intellectual heritage of earlier civilizations, both Eastern and Western. And so this included things from Egypt, Persia, as well as classical Greece and Rome. And in fact, it's only because of the preservation of many of these works, such as those of Aristotle, by Arabic scholars, that these works survived at all, and later were reintroduced into Europe where they'd been lost. Muslim scholars were especially good at creating sort of a synthesis of ideas. And so they would combine their ideas with knowledge from ancient Greece, from Persia, and from India. So, for example, from India, Islamic mathematicians got zero, and what is sometimes now erroneously called Arabic numerals, while the ancient Greeks provided them with much knowledge about geometry. And so putting together and building upon this fusion of Greek geometry and Indian knowledge of arithmetic, one 9th century Arabic mathematician, whose name was Muhammad ibn Musa al-Khwar Izmi, wrote innovative texts on a field which he called al-jabar, or integration. And you might recognize that in the modern form of what we call it, algebra. Science and medicine were also things that were pursued with great zeal. So hospitals were established, medical schools were set up, pharmacies were set up. And the state required that doctors had to pass medical exams before they could legally practice medicine. And by the year 931, Baghdad already had 860 licensed physicians. You can get a sense of their productivity from the work of two famous men. The first is a guy named Al-Razi, sometimes called Razes, who is a Persian doctor in charge of the Baghdad hospital. And he wrote 120 books on various medical topics. Among these was a famous one called On Smallpox and Measles. And this constituted the very first clear analysis of both the symptoms and the treatments of those diseases. It was also Al-Razi who advocated a system of classifying everything into the categories of animal, vegetable, or mineral. The second was another Persian scholar named Ibn Sina, and we know him in the West by his popular name Avicenna. He took the writings of ancient Greek physicians such as Hippocrates and Galen, and again combined those texts with the medical knowledge of the Islamic world. And the result was a multi-volume encyclopedia which was called the Canon of Medicine. And this was very widely disseminated, and eventually it was translated into Latin and became the main medical text used in Europe through the 17th century. Other scientific fields also flourished. Observatories were built, which allowed Muslim astronomers to make detailed observations of the sky, and which honed the accuracy of their calculations of things like the length of the solar year. They were also able to predict eclipses, and in those areas they even went beyond some of the work of the ancient Greeks. Alchemists worked in Baghdad, seeking to transform base metals into gold, or to find a sort of magic elixir that would grant immortality. And of course, they never did either of those two things, but they did establish chemical laboratories. And their experiments led to all sorts of advances, including how to conduct evaporation, sublimation, filtration, and crystallization. And around 800, these early chemists discovered distillation, and first created a pure form of what was called al-kul, literally the essence in Arabic, or again in English, what we term alcohol. By 800, the Abbasid Caliphate governed a population of about 30 million people. And its greatest ruler was probably a man named Harun al-Rashid, whose palace took up one-third of the city of Baghdad. He lived at the same time as the greatest European ruler of that era, Charlemagne. And there was an amicable diplomatic series of exchanges between them. Among the gifts that Harun al-Rashid sent to his Western counterpart was a very finely crafted, ornate water clock that, when it reached Europe, was regarded as a technological marvel. And these sort of gifts do reflect the technological sophistication, as well as the wealth and the luxury of the Abbasid Caliph and of the Islamic world in general in the 9th century AD. Even after that first wave of conquest was over, Islam continued to spread, often along trade routes and through merchants. And this was especially true in parts of Africa. Now, we haven't looked at sub-Saharan Africa very much in this course, because the major city-building empires of that region date to later eras. But it was right around the time of these great Islamic conquests that some of the first large urbanizing kingdoms began to appear in sections of Africa beyond just that narrow corridor along the Nile. Let's briefly look at what had been happening in some of these regions. So, central and southern African cultures had been heavily influenced by a great dispersion of peoples known as the Bantu migration, which seems to have begun around 500 BC. And the result was the spread of a bunch of groups who all shared similar cultural and linguistic characteristics. Among these was that they practiced a semi-nomadic lifestyle based around slash-and-burn agriculture, mingled in with a little herding of animals. One common thread among many early African civilizations was that they had a long history of what was really very advanced ironworking, and extended from this early period all throughout the Middle Ages. Probably the most notable of the early sub-Saharan African kingdoms was Aksum. This arose near the mouth of the Red Sea around the 3rd century BC. And Aksum, just by its geographical position, was well situated to control the sea trade that came from the Mediterranean down to the Red Sea and then off to India and the rest of the East. Aksum was also the point from which Mediterranean and Eastern merchants could access the goods of Southern Africa. And so there was a very rich trade through this kingdom in things such as ivory, frankincense, and myrrh, as well as slaves. In the early 300s AD, in a somewhat fascinating coincidence, at exactly the same time when the Roman Emperor Constantine was converting to Christianity, the king of Aksum also became a Christian. Now, in his case, it was to the Coptic form of Christianity, which was practiced in Egypt. And so from that point on, Aksum remained predominantly a Christian kingdom. One of the most impressive physical remains of this culture are a bunch of tall, thin stone steles. Some of these are more than 60 feet tall, and they mark royal tombs. In the 8th century AD, the Islamic conquests reached down into this region of Africa, and those conquests began to push the now declining Aksum Empire away from that coastline and the rich trade that went through it. So Aksum became displaced to the highlands in the interior, where it did continue for a couple more centuries, and gave rise to all sorts of legends in Europe of an African Christian ruler called Prester John. Meanwhile, in West Africa, other kingdoms were just starting to emerge, and the most important of these was Ghana. Ghana was based in the upper Niger River Valley in the Sudan, and seems to have begun developing around the late 4th century AD. But it reached a peak in the 9th century. This political entity, by the way, is not in the same location as the modern state of Ghana, which is further south. The foundation for the wealth of the ancient kingdom of Ghana was gold. It controlled some of the richest gold mines in all of Africa. And so by 800 AD, Ghana was a large, powerful kingdom that had begun to build several substantial cities. Gold would be exchanged with the Mediterranean through trade routes and caravans that would go right across the bleak Sahara Desert. And this trade picked up, especially after the Islamic conquest. And so again, Muslim merchants would go back and forth across the Sahara, transporting loads of gold, ostrich feathers, ivory and animal hides, and taking those to the Mediterranean. Ghana would be followed over the next couple centuries by other powerful mercantile West African kingdoms such as Mali, which ruled over the fabled markets of Timbuktu. As exemplified by the trans-Saharan trade routes, the Islamic world of the 8th and 9th centuries connected together many disparate cultures and places. Geographically, the Islamic political world stretched from Spain to India. But in terms of its economic and intellectual reach, its influence and its trade routes bound together very tightly the three continents of Europe, Africa, and Asia into a single kind of network that maybe would not be rivaled until much, much more modern times. Thank you.